Welcome to the Iron Basketball Podcast, brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com/CBSSports and use the offer code FUN, F-U-N. Welcome to the Iron Basketball Podcast, the Pick and Troll Podcast. I'm your host, Zach Harper. Special guest today, Jeff Skinwade, is joining us again. He was on before the season started to talk some Dallas Mavericks. Before that, though, we are going to get into some news and notes. And our news and notes segment is brought to you by Squarespace.com. Big news of the day. Well, not big news, but it is important news. Nick Young got robbed. Not of an award, not of a bad call, but during a Lakers game, his house got robbed. And they stole, I don't know, some jewelry, they stole some shoes, some clothes, some luggage, all very expensive stuff. TMZ reported this, so you know it's got to be legit. But yeah, the Nick Young house got robbed. Like, it's got to be an inside job. I got to believe this is some kind of like Ocean's 14 where they're trying to get it. Is it Izzy Azalea? Whoever his girlfriend is, I know she's some kind of musical artist. I think she's Australian. I feel like it's an inside job to try to steal some of her memorabilia, steal some of his stuff. You're gonna see it on Craigslist. You're gonna see it on eBay, and hopefully we can catch the guys. And I would hope he has a security system, like cameras and stuff. Like it, all professional athletes who have nice things should really have a security system in their place. Otherwise, I just feel like you're asking for these things to happen, because didn't Chris Bosh get robbed? We've had lots of NBA stars with things stolen from their home. So for all you NBA players listening, get a home security system with cameras and a closed circuit on all that stuff. Some news and notes, going to run down the NBA from last night real quick. Rockets handled the Bobcats, James Harden at 31 points. The Suns handled the Hawks pretty decently with a big third quarter. Eric Bledsoe had 20 points, I think, for his third straight game back. The Heat beat the Blazers. Chris Bosh with a game-saving block. LeBron James on the game-winning layup. And they won by two. No LaMarcus Aldridge for the Blazers. No Dwayne Wade for the Heat. The Pacers, they're not in trouble. I don't believe the Pacers are in trouble, but they're not playing well. They got manhandled by the Bulls. Lost by 12. Paul George had 21 points on 22 shots. He's just been really bad the last 3 months. Tyreke Evans reemerged as a savior, the savior of a crossover, of an in-and-out dribble, attacking the basket. He had 33, and I think he had like 33, 11, and 7 or something like that for the Pelicans. They beat the Nets in overtime. The Nuggets held Kevin Durant to under 30 points, mostly because it wasn't close enough to play him in the fourth quarter. He played 31 minutes, scored 27 points. Spurs beat the Sixers 25 straight. They covered that 21.5 point spread that Matt and I talked about yesterday. Spurs won by 22. It's 25 straight losses for the Sixers. They're one off the record. Only the 2010-2011 Cavs and the Sixers team have ever lost 25 straight games or more in an NBA season. Congratulations. Bucks lost in a competitive game against the Clippers. Ramon Sessions went nuts. Pistons destroyed the Jazz, which makes me believe the Jazz should have been higher in power tankings. I feel like I forgot. Oh, and then the Grizzlies destroyed the Timberwolves. Wasn't all that close, but Kevin Love did throw a 92-foot alley-oop to Corey Brewer that was on the money. Corey Brewer missed it, and the Wolves ended up getting blown out. But I can't remember who tweeted me this. If I was a better person, I would go look it up and give them credit. But someone said that was pretty symbolic of the Wolves season thus far. And I can't agree with you more. That pretty much sums up the entire deal. Now let's get to our guest, Skin Wade. He's part of the broadcast team for the Dallas Mavericks. Great guy. Great follow on Twitter, at Skin Wade. Let's get to that interview. Now I've got Jeff Skinwade from the Ben and Skin Show, a Dallas icon, I would say, a Dallas basketball icon. How's it going?
Good, man. How are you, Zach?
I'm doing all right. The Dallas Mavericks are in the thick of it, and I feel bad that the Wolves couldn't help them out Sunday against the Phoenix Suns.
I thought it was a real jerk move, and I blame you. I feel like I'm holding you responsible. Man, this is like this race is so tight between Dallas and Phoenix and Memphis, and it's such a wild emotional swing. Our play-by-play voice on the Mavs broadcast, Mark Folliwell, who will openly admit is a very emotional man, he was just about ready to throw his phone through a wall as we saw the – we were getting ready for the game last night and getting news that that thing is not ending up the way we needed it to. It's like, how did the, how do they come in here and they beat Dallas in overtime on Wednesday night and then turn around and spit the bit and lose such a big lead? So this is these are tense times around the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex as we head in towards the playoffs.
What you guys should do next year is just stop winning early on, and don't
that
win.
Kind of y'all's bit.
Yeah, don't win any close games, and then you can be virtually out of it at this point in the season. Then you don't have to worry about that kind of stuff.
Do I have this right? Did you guys lose? And I say you guys, but that's, let's face it, all of us who work in basketball media, we all have our favorite teams.
Exactly.
And die with them. Did the Wolves lose 11 straight games by four points or fewer if the result was that close? Did I have that number right?
Yeah, they lost their first 11 games. And I think at this point they're like 3-12 or 3-13, so on a hot streak.
We were watching them, obviously, Wednesday night when they came to town. And Derek Harper, who you know, the Mav Grady works on the broadcast, we were like, man, there's no way this team should be hovering around 500. But then again, when you just can't get over the hump. And I kind of remember, you know, the early days. The Mavericks had Finley and Nash and Dirk all in place when Cuban bought the team. And it was like just his presence immediately made things better. But I can remember them continuously losing all these close games over and over. I don't think it was anything as epic like 11 straight by four or less, but you just feel like you're snake bit, and then it just takes something, I don't know what it is, it takes something special, and then you get over the hump, and you're like, man, we were great. What happened? How come we didn't win these games? And then you get over that hump, and you're off and running. The talent is there in Minnesota. I mean, they've got their defensive problems, but that is not a team. That is a team that should be fighting for a 6th or 5th spot in the playoffs right now.
Yeah, and that's the thing that's confused me is that, you know, there are some losses that are just random, and they just never seem to get the right bounce. And then it does create, like, this energy where one thing goes wrong in the fourth quarter, and then there's a bad two-minute stretch, and that turns into a four-minute stretch. And I'm not on the road with the team, but for these home games, you can just feel the energy in the crowd and in the building with the team of just, oh, here we go again. Like, this is happening. And yeah. It doesn't seem to be an escape from it. What was the change for the Mavericks back when they had a young Dirk and a young Nash and a young Michael Finley?
It honestly and truly was Cuban buying the team, because the climate here, at least in sports media, was the, you know, everyone had turned on the Nelsons. And, you know, this was so funny, man. They used to run this thing in the paper where it was like daily comparisons of Dirk and Paul Pierce.
Right.
And so, I mean, I can't imagine anybody's ever engineered a draft day where you acquired two future MVPs within an hour of one another, which is what they did with Steve Nash and Dirk. But when Nash got here, he couldn't hit the broadside of a barn. He was inside his own head, and Dirk took a while to develop while Paul Pierce, you know, got off to an unbelievable start. So what happened was Cuban bought the team, and he had been a season ticket holder, so he knew that there was talent there. And he was, you know, initially, though they had their falling out, he was charmed by Nelly and liked what he saw with Donnie. And so when he made the announcement, I'm sticking with the Nelsons, like, none of the local media could believe it, but it just lifted this dark cloud over the franchise. And it was like, okay, here's a billionaire that recognizes what's here, and he's pumping life into it. And it was literally, they finished, Cuban acquired the team, I think, in January or February, and they finished that year strong. We're sniffing 500, and the next year they were off and running. It was literally just Cuban buying the team and saying, I'm sticking with what we got, and everything changed overnight.
And that feels like there's a chance of that happening. I mean, this team is very close. There is talent. You know, the future of Rick Adelman is uncertain because not everyone's all that convinced he's going to be here next season. And there is the Kevin Love cloud hanging over the organization, and maybe it's him, you know, re-upping in 2015, but you can't really count on that, so you almost have to hope for a Portland Trailblazers model of, you know, they make a couple of bench changes here in the off season, and and just find a way to reverse it, and you turn those LaMarcus Aldridge trade rumors that were there before this season into silly Kevin Love trade rumors before next season, and then hopefully have a winning year. I don't know.
Let me ask you this. I don't see the team enough, but when I do see them, I feel like, even though I really like both players a lot, I feel like Pekovic and Kevin Love aren't a good fit for one another. In other words, I always believe that if you have one four that's, you know, more of an inside guy and not crazy athletic, he needs to be paired with someone who's athletic. You know, the best example I could give you is before all the knee injuries, you had Vlade that was a space guy and you had Chris Webber that was the athlete. Or when the Mavericks played their best ball, they had Dirk and he was paired with springy Tyson Chandler. And I feel like, even though it's not, I'm not saying they're bad athletes, I just feel like Pekovic and Kevin Love aren't a ideal fit for one another. I almost feel like, you know, what I saw in that one game, and he's a million miles away from being consistent, but if Jane could develop into that, he's a better fit alongside Kevin Love, even if he's not a quote-unquote as good a player as Pekovic.
Yeah, I mean, with him doing so well in limited starting games since Peck's been out, a lot of people have around here have wondered the same thing. I mean, the problem with them is they work so well offensively, and defensively, you really need a sound unit with them. I mean, Ricky Rubio's been a fantastic defender for most of the season. He had a couple of lulls here and there, but he's been really good. And outside of that, I mean, Kevin Martin's a horrendous defender.
Yeah.
And Corey Brewer gambles just way too much. And those guys are not the type of – I mean, you can – if you play solid position defense with Love and Peck on the floor, you know, they can dominate the boards and end possessions for you. But if you have one guy who's a saloon door on one end of the wing and another guy who's just gambling all over the place and not, and when he, you know, he gambles what correctly twice a game and gets a steal. I mean, that's in a 100 possession game. That's not ideal. You're just leaving those two having to cover this middle of the floor and they don't do that well. And then that leaves the basket open. And it's just, it's a situation. What's interesting is that I'm looking it up, and the Wolves actually, by defensive rating, have a much better defense than the Mavericks, and yet the Mavericks have the third best offense in the league, and it doesn't matter how bad their defense is. They've just managed to hang on for all these close wins, and I'm sure a lot of that is having Dirk Nowitzki as your go-to guy down the stretch.
Yeah, interesting comment the other night after the Denver win. The Mavericks finally beat Denver, who had just given them all kinds of fits. Denver came in here Friday night with a chance to sweep the Mavericks.
Wow.
And so when you're looking at this tight playoff race, you're going, okay, we got swept by Toronto and got swept by Brooklyn, and those are good teams that ended up having good seasons, but you need to split. And Denver comes in here with all their problems, and they're trying to sweep you. But Brian Shaw said that the Mavericks are the best shooting team from all over the floor in the league. I'm kind of paraphrasing that. His point is that they shoot the ball really well from every spot on the floor. And for that reason, it makes them very difficult to defend. And so when you get to the end of the game and you're going, all right, I've got there's times, for example, where the Mavericks will roll with Monte Ellis and Dirk, and they'll be in some sort of two-man game action, and they're spreading the floor with Calderon, who's a great shooter, and Vince Carter, who's a very, very good shooter. And sometimes they'll have Brandon Wright in there, and he can, you know, he's active, or maybe they'll go with D'Alembert, maybe even Marion, and they'll go small. But they've got the floor spread so well, which was the exact opposite of the team last year that couldn't spread the floor and had so many problems, and they were inefficient in pick and roll, that Monte is very decisive. And so when he comes off Dirk and he's got the ball, he's done a great job of distributing. And so if teams lead those shooters, he finds them and they knock it down. If not, he gets to the rim or finds Dirk. And the offense has been great. I think last time I checked, they were the number three team in terms of offensive efficiency with their rating. And
yep.
They're not even playing a crazy fast pace. I think they're 15th in the league in terms of pace. But they make the most of those possessions. What's freaking people out right now, they're never going to stop anybody. They're just not good enough defensively on the perimeter, much like Minnesota. And a lot of times they're small in there, so they don't clear the glass. So they've got to be just brilliant offensively. And they've hit a stretch here. It's an 8-game homestand. They're 2-2 on it with home games coming up of Oklahoma City tomorrow night, the Clippers on Thursday, then they get a reprieve with the Kings, and then they host Golden State. So it's about to get really difficult. They're only 2-2 on the stretch so far. And Dirk has looked kind of dead-legged in two of the last three games. Really, really all three of them, but they just didn't need him against Denver. And so last night, Dirk is 2-for-12 from the floor, and passing up shots. He's like throwing laser passes to D'Alembert under the basket in overtime. We're going, "Don't, what are you doing? We don't care. You shoot the ball." And so there's kind of a, I don't know, a mini crisis right now at the wrong time, because these teams are so bunched together, and people are like, "All right, do you sit Dirk for a game?" Because they did that earlier in the year, about a month and a half ago at Toronto, and he came back and he played brilliantly after that. So it's like, is it as simple as just give him 2 or 3 days off, and can you afford to do that with, you know, so many good teams coming in? So that's kind of the mini crisis in Dallas, because the overall crisis of defense and rebounding is not going to get solved this year.
Is that something where you think that maybe even restricting his minutes, like if you play him 26, 28 minutes for a game or two, that would give him enough rest, or does he actually need rest?
I think he actually needs a game off. I think at this point, and, you know, I don't, you know, it's a good question, right? It's like, well, when do you start doing that? Well, Popovich has done a great job of, you know, extending the career of Tim Duncan. I can remember a couple of years ago, in fact, it was right after the championship season for Dallas, you know, we had these couple big segments on the air where we were talking about the Dirk watch, the idea of, is he coming up? I'm sure you remember Charles Barkley famously saying father time with
yeah.
Dirk, because, you know, he'd come off the season, the championship, the long window because of the strike and all this sort of stuff, and he had some knee problems. And so anyways, at that time, you know, Tim Duncan – looked like, okay, he's definitely on a downside. And then 2 seasons later, he's first-team All-NBA. And so he's a couple years older than Dirk, has more mileage. But I think that that's a good model just in terms of, you know, the new style of four, Kevin Garnett, to some degree, Tim Duncan. I always maintain he's a center, but he's got some, you know, of the newer four skills. Chris Webber, those guys. Dirk is a part of that group. And when do you really have to start having them miss games? Dirk is the guy who never wants to miss a game. He's furious if he has to miss a game. And when you get to the end of years, if you're doing really well and you get to this whole rest versus rust thing that's going to come up for everybody here in a week, Dirk never wanted to sit. But there is a point where San Antonio has proved, I think, with Duncan, you need to have those guys take a game or two off, because what matters most is April and May and beyond. And so that's a big question around here right now, and it's just the bad timing for the Mavericks because they got so many tough games on their schedule and they can't afford to take a night off. But I think it would do Dirk a lot of good if he could grind through tomorrow night and grind through Thursday and then maybe take the Kings game off and then be ready to rock and roll. That would give him Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday off before dealing with Golden State. If he can fight through these next 2 games, I would like to see him take a seat for that Saturday night game against Sacramento.
And then you have, I mean, after the end of this homestand in LA for a back-to-back with the Clippers and Lakers,
yep,
in Sacramento, in Utah, I mean, you know, the Clippers game will be tough, and then you've got a back-to-back, but that's almost a very sweepable road trip if you can take that Clipper game.
Yeah, and here they've had a couple – this is a very important week, I think, for the Mavericks just in terms of seeding and if they do make the playoffs and who they feel good about. They've played the Clippers twice. The first time they played the Clippers, that was the game where Chris Paul suffered his injury. That happened in the third quarter. The Mavericks built up a big lead and then lost it late in the game. Then they played the Clippers in L.A., you know, a few weeks later. Chris Paul still hurt. They built up a massive lead. They were literally rolling the Clippers. I mean, they were blowing them out and then got involved. And I know you've seen this a lot where teams get involved in these head games with Blake Griffin and can we take him out of the game. And I think the Mavericks got taken out of that game playing, you know, trying to play games with Griffin. So those were two horrible losses where they had big leads against the Clippers with Chris Paul not being available, and they spit the bit at the end of the game. So this game Thursday night I think is huge because it's a Clipper team that's absolutely smashing people, and who knows how the seeding's going to work out. Maybe the Clippers could reach, you know, being a 1 or 2 seed, but they need to really at least be competitive and play well against the Clippers because I think they got to beat them at least once in these next 2 games that they have them here over the next 10 days, just from a confidence standpoint.
Absolutely. I mean, we've got 11 games left in this Mavericks season. Is 8-3 maybe the worst you can go? Or because the key will obviously, I mean, they're all huge games at this point, but, you know, you finish the season home into Phoenix in Memphis.
Yep.
I mean, that's probably your season right there.
I think it's your season. And the other thing, too, is the game before. See, you have San Antonio on a Thursday night at home, and who knows if Popovich is, if it's going to be the Patty Mills show or
right.
C.C. Parker, who knows what he's doing. And then we have, because they're going to be neck and neck with Oklahoma City, and then we have Phoenix, and keep in mind that's a tiebreaker game. The Mavericks only play Phoenix three times this year, and they've split the first two games. So I think I really, you know, we're looking at schedules and projecting. I think Memphis is going to pass Dallas, and I think they're going to pass them at such a clip that that final game of the year, Memphis may be sitting their guys. Who knows? It's got, to me, it's going to come down to Dallas and Phoenix, and it's going to come down to that Saturday night game in Dallas because it's going to be a tiebreaker game, and their records are going to be so close. So, I mean, you're right. 8-3 is 7-4 not going to be enough? It's really, I think that going into that game, you know, Phoenix or Dallas, second to last game of the season, are going to be like, all right, which one of us does this push us to 48 wins? It's just, there's just no margin for error. And every team is like this, but you look back and you go, man, so many losses to Denver, those Clipper games we blew. You know, they got swept by Toronto. They're up 20-something on Toronto, and Toronto came back on them in Dallas's building. So those are all frustrating games when you look back this time of year and it's this tight.
That is the thing. I mean, talk about the Wolves and their close losses. Is that Toronto one maybe the most frustrating? Is it the Clippers loss where they were up and then they got in those head games with Blake Griffin? I mean, what is the loss that you think may ultimately just be the most frustrating way to give up a playoff berth if they don't make it?
I think for me it's that Clippers game on the road for the simple fact that is not only – you know, there's games that have lingering impact in terms of how you feel about yourself.
Right.
And you feel really good when you go. I mean, let's face it, man. The Clippers are kind of like the punks of the NBA. I mean, I would like for some of those guys to sniff a conference finals before they're that cocky. But, you know, that's how Chris Paul's always been. Doc Rivers obviously knows what he's doing. I think he's a great coach. I'm not breaking any news there. And I think there's two guys. You know, when people always talk about, man, he's one of the most underrated players in the league. They're always going to talk about guys on their rookie contracts. I think Blake Griffin and Russell Westbrook are the two most underrated players in the league. To hear people talk, I mean, I hear people all the time like, man, you gotta get rid of Westbrook so the Thunder can be good. I mean, he's in Kevin Durant's way.
He's like one of the seven best players in the league.
You're nuts. He's like a 25-year-old all-NBA guy.
Right.
25-year-olds don't know how to play NBA ball yet. I mean, very, very few guys really have it together at that age. And the criticisms of Blake Griffin are hilarious to me. Like, what is he, 22? How old is Blake Griffin? He's a kid.
Yeah, I think he's 23, maybe 24.
It's nuts how good he's going to end up being. And, you know, but people talk like they've let the league down, and they're not – it's like, man, I don't get that, and I think that – if the Mavericks had gone in there and held that big lead and punked them and did what they did, it has a ripple effect that changes a lot of games. So instead of punking the Clippers, they came back and punked you. And I think that that's probably, for me, the lowest point of the season. That a quote-unquote veteran team with guys like Dirk and Vince Carter. Vince Carter was involved in it, too. Vince Carter tried to sucker Blake Griffin into a tech. Sean Marion. These veteran guys blew that game, and I think that for me is the real disappointing loss.
I want to remind you that today's podcast is brought to you by Squarespace.com, where you can easily create your own professional website or online portfolio. Squarespace constantly improving their platform, new features, new designs, even better support. Have beautiful designs for you to start with, great templates to really get you going, get you into the process of building your website, all the options you'd really want to make it look great and make it a unique experience for you and your business. That includes mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website. Content's going to look great no matter where you look at it. Incredibly easy to use. If you need some help, though, Squarespace can have your back. Over 100 Squarespace employees ready for you, based in New York, the Care Bear Lair, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No matter when you need help, if you need help, they're there for you. And really inexpensive, $8 a month, includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year, which is a really great deal. especially if you want to just kind of test out whether or not you need a website or not, see what you can build, what kind of momentum you can grab online. It's a really inexpensive way to start out. You can start a free trial with no credit card required. Start building your website today. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, please go to squarespace.com/CBSSports. You're going to make sure to use the offer code FUN, that's F-U-N. You're going to get 10% off. You show your support for the I Am Basketball podcast, and we thank Squarespace for their support of the podcast because it's everything you need to create an exceptional website. For me, I mean, talking about Blake Griffin, it's so frustrating to me that people still think, like, whether you like him or not, I don't care, but he's been an unbelievable player. He's been one of the five best players in the league this year,
Yes. Just
in terms of season. Like, I actually wish he would get most improved player. Like, I know that you're not supposed to give it to somebody that good, but I think the leap he's made from last year to this year, like, that's probably a harder leap to make than someone going from their rookie year to their sophomore year as a player. And I look at him and I'm like, this guy's got to get some kind of accolade. Like, he'll get an all NBA, maybe, probably not first team because they'll give it to LeBron and Durant, but he'll get a second team. And it's just like, you look at him playing, like, yeah, think he's a jerk, think he's a wuss, whatever, but you've got to think he's a great player.
I think he's a great player, and the other thing about it is he is being treated by the I haven't seen anybody being treated the way he's been treated since the NBA basically let guys beat up on Shaq because no one could officiate him.
Yeah.
You know, where it was like, it was okay to put both of your hands in Shaq's back and push him as hard as you can. Like, it was just so absurd, and it wasn't fair, and no one knew how to officiate him. Every game, every time I flip on a Clippers game, someone's trying to push him and get in his head and trip him and get in a physical altercation, and you look and it's always like, you know, that team's version of a hockey goon, and he's got to put up with that nonstop, and he had to lead his team when Chris Paul got hurt for so long. I think he's been phenomenal this year, and I think anyone who's trying to say that he's not a superstar has lost their mind. I think I can support your most improved player movement for Blake Griffin. I think that's a good platform.
You know, who's also been improved is Monte Ellis. And I don't know if he's been improved, but he's just been really good. And you know, it seems like he's kind of – maybe this is just a bad comparison because it's what I'm used to with the Mavericks, but he seemed to have slid into that Jason Terry role pretty nicely. I mean, he's not the shooter Terry was, but – but you know, the playmaker, I love that comment you made earlier about, like, he makes decisions. Like, you know that he's not going to kill the offense in terms of, you know, just holding the ball. Like, he will make a decision, good or bad, and I think that keeps that offense, that third best offense in the league, really flowing.
Yeah, he's the key. I mean, and it's how him and Dirk work off of one another and how the floor is spaced. And you know, I know we talked about this before, where last year the biggest problem for the Mavs was Mayo and Collison being unsure of what to do with the ball.
Right.
Monte knows what to do with the ball. And when he's on the floor with good players, he's going to make more than likely the right decision. I think for the most part, he's made the right decision this year. And he's leading the team in assists. He's shown that he can be a really good facilitator. And he's shown a willingness. Your comparison to Jet, I think, is interesting in that, you know, so much of the Mavericks' offense at the end of games for so many years was the two-man game with Jason Terry and Dirk. What Jet wanted to do is he would always go right, and he wanted to kind of get in that little mid-range area, take a hard dribble, and pull up and knock down a mid-range jumper. There has never been, and I am someone who has seen a lot of Mavericks basketball. You know, I was there in the 80s when they had Aguirre and Harper and all those guys, and there's never been anyone in the history of the Dallas Mavericks that could get to the rim like Monte Ellis. There's been guys, and finish. Steve Nash could obviously get to the rim, but he wasn't a threat to score at the rim the way Monte is. He, you know, Nash would break the defense down. But he is such a threat, and there's a great article that Jordan Brenner had written for the ESPN, the magazine analytics issue, where he came in town and he talked to Roland Beach, you know, the Mavs, famous stat guy that works for the Mavs. And he was giving them all kinds of good insight, including something we reference on the broadcast now called heap plays, where those are all the times that Monte gets to the basket and ends up in a heap on the floor because he takes so much abuse. It's almost Iverson-like, right? And, you know, how the ripple effect of the heap play. It could be that he gets to the line. It could be a made bucket. It could be an offensive rebound because he sucked so many guys in. It could be a kick out for a three. there, it could be he's gotten a lot of hockey assists this year. There's so many good positive benefits to having Monte Ellis. And I know he had a bad reputation, and I know a lot of times it takes guys longer to mature and all that. And sometimes guys don't handle bad situations well, and let's face it, Milwaukee's a bad situation. But, you know, I'm around the team quite a bit, and I would say that Monte Ellis has been a great presence here. I mean, I love having him here. I love watching him play. I think he's been a real good dude off the court, and that was a home run signing for the Mavs.
And the Calderon signing also has just been, I mean, you know, that backcourt defensively is not ideal, I would say, but offensively, that spacing that they do create, and they, you know, they can both make such great decisions with the ball, with the options that they have in front of them. You know, it was supposed to be something that was maybe their undoing this year, and it's really been a positive for them.
I think the interesting thing is that Calderon is such a good spot up shooter. The way the Mavericks have kind of been starting games, they really put Calderon in some pick and roll situations, and he's really good about getting to a spot and knocking down, almost Jason Terry like, knocking down that mid range shot. But when they put the ball in Monte's hands, for the majority of the second half, we're seeing a lot. Calderon helps space that floor, you know, so much. And I think it was more coincidence than anything, but Calderon ended up playing off the ball in Spain this summer when he was playing for the Spanish team.
Yeah.
Because, you know, just the way their personnel was, they needed him to play off the ball. So it was almost like a lucky thing for the Mavericks that ramping up, because they signed Calderon first, the Monte thing fell in their laps. And, in fact, I don't know if you remember this story, they had committed 3 years and $9 million to Devin Harris.
Right.
And then Devin Harris had the injury, and so they agreed to undo his contract. Well, you know, that opened up, you know, some money and some space for them to sign Monte. And I think it just was fortuitous that's how Calderon spent his summer, because he slid right into that situation for Dallas. And by the way, the Devin Harris thing was a blessing. They were the first half of this year, and some of these games they lost was because they would go to Gal Meckel, who's really not ready for NBA ball, or Shane Larkin, who's not ready to run a team, and they didn't have, you know, a good backup point guard situation. Devin Harris, since he's been back, has been a godsend for this team, especially defensively. He's come in and give them a burst, you know, in terms of tempo and pace. So they've got a pretty good ball handling situation now with Monte and Devin Harris and Jose Calderon. It's worked out really well for them offensively.
You were there for the Wolves Mavericks game. Describe the moment to me when you realized that JJ Barea had just tried to perform a tip dunk in a game.
That was incredible. And when it happened, it looked and felt more impressive than when we saw the replay, because when we saw the replay, it reminded me of the dudes in high school that try and dunk tennis balls.
Right.
They can't dunk a basketball.
Right.
But what he did was he slid baseline and I think he bounced off too, if I remember correctly, and grabbed the rim and had his hands on the ball but couldn't get it to flush, and then kind of did the pull-up, you know, on the rim so that it looked a little more impressive. But it was a hilariously awesome moment, because we were all like, if there's any team in the league that J.J. Barea is going to get a dunk putback in traffic against, it's going to be the Mavericks. I mean, there's no doubt he gets up. Even if he doesn't play well against Dallas, he definitely gets up for playing against Dallas. And I know Corey's the same way. Corey really gets up to play against Dallas. And what, do you have three of those breakaway layups in the first quarter?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that Barea moment was really hilarious, really awesome, and I almost wish he had done it in hindsight.
Oh, I do too. I mean, when it happened, it tricked my mind, because I thought, oh God, Dante Cunningham, what are you doing? Like, why would you do that? Like, and then I saw the replay. I was like, wait, that was JJ Barea just tried to tip dunk? What just happened? And it fooled everyone so much that Cunningham got, at least in the official box score, he got the offense or the interference.
Is that right?
Yeah, they credited him with the interference. Like, nobody knew that J.J. Barea did it in real time.
No, that was Barea. It was a beautiful moment, man. We had a good chuckle about that on the break. Because another thing, too, man, is, you know, everyone around here loves J.J. Like, and probably nobody loves him more than Dirk in terms of folks on the team. Dirk loves J.J. But, man, you will not find a broadcasting dude that's a bigger fan of his than Derek Harper. Harper loves Barea because Harper likes, you know, tough-minded dudes that just don't, I mean, Barea's used to people doubting him. And it's really funny, man. There's, like, I think JJ's probably the current guy in the NBA that, like, you know, dudes playing at the park think that they can beat.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah, oh, no, I could get that guy. There's no doubt in my mind I could beat that guy. J.J. Barea is a tank. Like, just look at his forearms. He's got Popeye forearms. The dude is really stout. And when he goes in there and absorbs contact and bounces off of you, he's really strong and he can finish. And I just think that people get the wrong idea about what he is. He is a strong tank of a dude.
It's funny you mention that because Britt Robson, who's just a fantastic local basketball writer, and he's done some stuff for Sports Illustrated in the past, he and I have had this conversation a lot during the season of what must it have been like at Northeastern with this guy just stepping onto a court. Like, he's the ultimate, like, ringer in a pickup game in terms of NBA guys.
Yeah.
Because he must have stepped onto so many courts, and you have, you know, a really impactful NBA player. Like, he hasn't been good this year, but he's helped a team win a championship before. I mean, he must have just destroyed guys in random pickup games.
Yeah, and the other thing is, I bet he probably got in some fights with some dudes and took care of them.
I would imagine so. He is a tough guy.
How absurd it is. J.J. Barea started finals games for a championship team.
Yeah.
It's pretty incredible. And I always think about him too, and I think about the difference in your average. Like, it's all relative, right? But, you know, there's so many times where people will make fun of the quote unquote spares of the league. Like, oh, that guy, you know, he's a spare, barely gets in. When JJ would go down and play in the D League, he would drop 40 on him on a regular basis. It wasn't like he would go down to the D League and get 18. He would go down and dominate those games. I mean, just dominate them. And so whenever guys, you know, bounce back and forth from the NBA to the D League, I'm always interested in seeing, you know, how they do. Like, Jay Crowder went through a recent stretch where he fell out of the rotation. And so they wanted to get his attention, and they sent him to the D League, which, you know, Jay's a proud guy. Jay Crowder is. I'm sure it hurt his ego. What did he do? He had back-to-back triple-doubles in the D League. Like, when you're an NBA guy and you go down there, you should dominate that. And that's what J.J. did. And when people would go, oh, he's just a little guy, he's barely on the team. No, he is a baller. And, you know, he had the perfect role here. And I realize Minnesota signed him because they wanted some veteran, you know, backcourt savvy and some of those kinds of things. And I don't think he's probably worked out ultimately the way Minnesota had hoped that he would work out. But, you know, he's carved out an amazing little niche for himself in the league. He's a baller.
Oh, I agree. And I think, I mean, he's been bad this year, but he's also had units that he's leading that just give him no space, and so he can't operate, and then he's got to force it, and it's just been a problem in that sense. I'm glad you bring up the D-League. I've got two more questions for you. I have an affinity for gunners. Jamal Crawford, Nick Young, J.R. Smith, I love these guys. I'm obsessed with the mentality they have. I kind of see that in Ricky Lito a little bit, and I've been obsessed with him since he didn't play in college at Providence, but I, you know, watching his high school stuff and his AAU stuff and then seeing him in the D-League. Is there any chance that he comes through for me and my love for gunners and he becomes a good role player in the NBA?
Yeah, I think there is. And for me personally, and I know, you know, different people in the organization, my hope is not that he's this player, but my hope is that he ends up being a Lance Stevenson type find for the Mavericks.
Yeah.
Where, you know, there were circumstances that, you know, led to things not going smooth for him, but he had a great reputation in terms of his on-the-court stuff. And the interesting thing about Lito is that he's a big fan. He wants to be like Penny Hardaway.
Ooh.
He kind of sees himself as a guy that can make plays as a facilitator as well. But one thing to kind of support your whole gunner notion is he had been in the D-League, and then he came back because of injury, checked into a game, and drained a three. You know, it's like his first shot is like that sort of mentality of, I belong. You know, there was an interesting debate where Cuban had kind of started it. And around here in Dallas, everyone went nuts for SMU basketball for a month. So Larry Brown was answering a lot of questions. And Larry Brown had to respond to Mark Cuban's assertion that, you know, these guys don't want to go to college to just go to the D League. And Larry Brown was like, well, I disagree with that. I mean, obviously he's got his own agenda, but he's like, there's things you got to learn about basketball that you're not going to be taught in the D League. And I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
If you go to the right program, you know, I'm a big believer in Larry Brown. When I was a little kid, I used to go to Kansas basketball camp, you know, when I was a junior high age kid. And, you know, I still remember things I learned there. And I remember seeing R.C. Buford there, who's, you know, now a GM for the Spurs. And I didn't know him at the time, but Popovich was there and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, when you go to a program that's got people that know basketball, they can teach stuff to you that you're not going to get in the D League because of the schedule, the nature of it, all those sorts of things. So I think Ricky Lito would be a million times better if he had been able to play a year of college basketball at least. But I think there's a lot of potential there, and I do have this sort of dream that he can be a Lance Stephenson-type find for the Mavericks.
Yeah, I like that comparison. I think that could be a role that, because he does have some playmaking ability, and he's rangy, and he's got some strength to him, so I like that.
He wants to do that. He wants to be able to make plays like that.
A really weird story that propped up today, and you actually had him on your radio show. People for about 10 minutes thought Quentin Ross was dead. Former Mavs player, former Clipper player, and turns out it's just another person named Quentin Ross, which it's still terrible that this person was murdered, or it seems like they were murdered. But what was, I mean, you had him on, what insight did he give you for those that didn't get to listen to the radio show?
He was just sort of like talking about how weird it is to be woken up to people to see if you're alive. Because he's back in Dallas now. And,
okay.
He'd retired because of some back issues, and I think he's moving towards getting into coaching because Quentin's only 32 years old.
Right.
But he's from here. He went to Kimball High School, which has been a real good, basketball program here. Played at SMU and then bounced around the league. And he was actually, if I remember correctly, part of the trade that Dallas sent him as part of that Caron Butler deal where they got Caron Butler and Deshaun and Brendan Haywood and all that. But he was a really nice guy and doesn't strike me as the kind of guy that would get into trouble. So the story comes down, and the New York Post has it to where it's like Quentin Ross owed all these people money. And my first thought is Quentin Ross has not burned through $6 million before the age of 32. That's not who he is.
Right.
Like, he's not flashy. And I know he played overseas, too. I have a hard time believing this. But, well, it's in the paper, and they have it identified as former NBA player. I was like, God, I can't believe that. And I sent a text message to someone in the organization, and I was like, do you have a number for Quentin Ross? I want to reach out to him. I want to see if this is him. And they're like, we're shocked over here. We can't believe it. This is not Quentin. This is not who he is. And so I have a buddy that, used to play with him around town, and they'd go play pickup games and stuff. And I was like, man, I'm sorry. Are you hearing this? Is Quentin dead? And he didn't get back to me. So then I called him, and he answered the phone, and he was shook up. And I go, man, listen, the New York Post is now saying that it's a different Quentin Ross. And he didn't believe me. He goes, no, I'm checking on this, man. I go, dude, the people that reported that he's dead are now saying it's not him, so you're fine. Track him down. We want to have him on the show. So he actually tracked him down, got a hold of him, and Quentin jumped on. It was only for about 5 minutes, but it was really more just about the surreal experience of, jumping online and seeing everyone saying that you're dead. Because he was like, man, I've taken good care of my money. I'm looking for my next career in basketball. Everything's going to be fine. It's just kind of a weird thing to suddenly, because like when the whole world's trying to get a hold of you, something ain't right. And that's kind of like what he was dealing with. He's like, man, people really want to get a hold of me right now.
Oh, that's just crazy. Well, Skin, I can't thank you enough for hopping on. And I do have to say that I should have listened to you with my preseason predictions. I had you on before the season. You told me the Mavericks were going to be okay. I wanted to lean that way. I got talked out of it. And next season, I'm listening to you 100%.
Very good. I think just let listeners of the podcast know that they should always turn to me for guidance in all things, anywhere in the world, and it'll work out really well.
You are my new life coach. We can follow you on Twitter @SkinWade. Thank you so much.
All right, Zach. Take care, brother.